Welcome to Physique Star Radio, brought to you by Myotropics and Dr. Scott Connolly. Here are your hosts, Ian Lauer and Vince Andrich.
Welcome to Physique Star Radio. We're your hosts. I'm Ian Lauer with Vince Andrich. We're the place where you want to go if you're trying to build the physique you've always wanted. And if you already have it, we're going to help you learn how to do with it what you want to do with it. So, Vince, you're already doing it with your physique. What are your first tips and thoughts on creating that physique?
I'm doing it. I was just reading an article the other day, and I was, you know, going back to the whole GTL, gym, tan, laundry, and I realized that my life is now gym, work, family, not necessarily in that order. But I used to do the GTL. Is that pretty much your day a lot of times?
Well, you know, this week is like most other weeks. It's gym, and I don't really do the tanning so much. I do the spray instead. Just much faster, and I figure when I'm 70, it'll serve me a little better than being in the fake bake repeatedly. We'll find out one way or another, right? As long as it looks real, right?
Yeah, I think you're going the right route. I can tell you, I was grew up in Las Vegas, and found a tanning salon while I was still in high school. So, you know, you used to stand up and it burnt you in like 3 minutes. So I got the brunt of that. You don't want any part of that.
I'll pass today.
Yeah.
But you know, when these guys are competing in physique, I mean, of course they have a tan, and that's something that does come up. And a lot of guys do tan a lot before the show, and then they do the tan on top of that, the spray tan. So that is something where guys have to decide, you know, if they want to build a solid base tan or if they want to apply an extra coat or two of the spray. So that is something that, whether it be for a photo shoot or for the stage, it's always a question.
Yeah. Do you get any base in a bed or outside, or naturally got some dark pigment in your skin? Pretty much. You're not that fair at all, right?
Well, you know, I give Casper a run for his money. I'm about one shade darker than him. But even though I'm in Venice, I'm basically in Golds and back at my place and on the road. And I get a little sun in the car when I'm traveling back and forth, but not too much. But, you know, I wanted to bring this up, and I want to talk to you a bit about this. I don't know if you had a chance to thoroughly read through what Zane's thoughts were on the men's physique division.
Yeah, well, I did, and I have a few thoughts on it, but it was...
listeners, I'm going to go ahead and just paraphrase this a bit. This is out of his The Building of the Body, Spring 2011. It's out of his publication that he puts out, and I was a bit surprised when I heard this coming from Zane, but his thought on the physique, according to what he wrote, is... and I quote, "Another wrong turn in bodybuilding is the physique division, recently added to most contests. Everything bodybuilding argued that it was not. This is times 10. Bodybuilding said it was not a beauty contest, but a sport, that posing was a way to display development, not just prancing around showing off. But that is exactly what's done in the physique division. There are no standard poses, just walking around looking cutie, and best of all, they wear knee-length board shorts, so no need for uncomfortable leg workouts." So, you know, when I first read this, I was personally offended, being that I'm a physique athlete. I mean, I train legs. I mean, I get under the squat bar, and I do my reps. I get in the leg press. But what are your thoughts on it?
Well, and you know what? I know you train legs, and, we all have the utmost respect for Frank Zane, let's face it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The guy... you know, ironically, he would be the face of physique. He always was. He would be that now. But to say that it's another wrong turn, I definitely don't agree with that, because when he says everything bodybuilding arguably was not supposed to be like a beauty contest, well, it went away from the art of posing because there was too much. You know, back in the day, it was shape, symmetry, and thin size, okay? And they looked for things like muscle separation and things like that. And now it's more so mass and then the separation. But, you know, I don't even know if you see the kind of posing that went into, let's say, the 70s and 80s. Periodically you do, but I don't even think they judge on it anymore. I could be wrong. So this is progress. You know, you're dialing it back. Where bodybuilding went or has gone is it's not even an aesthetic contest. You know, if you want to call it a beauty contest, there's no aesthetic to it anymore. So if you think posing brings the aesthetic piece back, that could be argued, but there's no doubt that the aesthetics have been gone for a long time, in my view.
Well, it seems, yeah, mass is definitely there, and then extreme conditioning. And, you know, you have to think, well, where are the lines, you know? And so I feel that physique is clearly an attempt to bring some of that back. Now, I mean, when Zane says, you know, the long shorts, I mean, that's something that a lot of us would love to see go to a shorter short. For those of us that do train our wheels, we can get them out there and spin them around on stage a little bit.
Right.
But, you know, that's something that I think is going to take time. I mean, this is a new division, not even a year old yet, really. So, I mean, there will be changes that take place. Now, is that going to happen? I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Vince?
Well, I think only time will tell and see where they... My guess is that there's going to be probably some kind of standardized short, and there probably will wind up being some poses. I don't know what those may or may not be, but I think it's going to be a progression. And so if, you know, Zane... I don't know if he wants to just like go back to the golden era, but this is a new golden era, and you're not going to go back to the days when guys could look like Frank Zane and actually be Mr. Olympia, because he probably couldn't be as great as he was. He couldn't be a state champion now because of the way it's been graded.
So, well, that's a really good point. And because if you were to put Zane in his heyday on the stage next to the guys today, I mean, his lines would still be awesome, but when it comes to mass and the crazy conditioning, you're right. It's a different ballgame now in the bodybuilding community. And I mean, in my opinion, like that's the physique that what the majority of us physique guys are chasing. It's like trying to go to that point seems to be the goal for a lot of these guys.
Well, yeah, my thought is that there'll be a place for the regular bodybuilding, let's call it, the hardcore bodybuilding, because let's face it, to each his own. You know, if a guy's bigger, he may want to roll with that. That's great. But if you wanted to be a Zane, where would you go? So the argument is now you have a place to go. You don't see Zane versus Arnold anymore in bodybuilding. So those days are gone. So at least the men's physique division now brings an opportunity to a lot of guys who would want to emulate a guy like Frank Zane.
Well, and you can just see by the growth in the division this year. I mean, it was huge. I mean, the number of guys that showed up. I mean, when was it Nationals Miami? I mean, there were right at or almost 70 guys in the tall class alone. I mean, that's huge. So, yeah, it's just amazing how far this division has come in such a short period of time. So I'm really looking forward to seeing hopefully some of these other things happen and getting even more guys interested in competing.
Right. Well, I think I mentioned to you, it's like, you know, what would Zane do in the current climate?
Right.
Would he choose to never compete? Or would he say men's physique is is at least a start?
Right.
So... you know, I think it's just going to be really good because nowadays a guy can create an awesome physique without, you know, going to the dark side or going to an extreme pharmaceutical methodology right. Because the techniques are more refined now. The nutrition is better. We know way more than we did in the 70s, 80s. And so now, you know, guys are going to come out of the woodwork because if they looked at bodybuilding from the magazine photographs, in my case, and I know a couple of guys, one very, very, very prominent bodybuilder who told me on the phone, he was a pro, he was like a top five in the Olympia, and he said, if I saw the images today, you know, even being the gym rat I am, I would have never gone into bodybuilding. Just, I wouldn't have. And so, you know, and this guy arguably had probably one of the best physiques as well, Bob Paris. But he said, you know, why would I want to go there? It just wasn't for him. So,
well, the other thing, the other difference is if you are a physique competitor, even if you are national level, you can still live your everyday life. Now, yeah, I mean, of course, you have to pack your food when you're traveling and you have to do all of that. But you can put on a regular shirt and a regular pair of jeans and continue to live for the most part a normal life, which in order to compete at the level, the IFBB level or national level for bodybuilding is, I would imagine, next to impossible to be able to do that.
Well, it's definitely tough. And you see a guy like Phil Heath, who just won last year at Mr. Olympia. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a guy that has unbelievable lines, but he's just so big.
Oh, he's huge.
And so, you know, if you want to look at somebody that's aesthetic and big, he is. But who can roll with that guy? It's very difficult. And I just think that the talent pool becomes smaller over time because people are like, I can't roll there. Now right. The talent pool is going to get bigger because there's a lot of guys that probably think they can roll in physique and can.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think Frank made another point about, you know, they said it's was never a sport because it was kind of a beauty contest. It's like, I think the physique is going to make it a sport, and I'm not talking about the competitive part of it. I'm talking about having a life and being able to train, eat right, and supplement, and have this lifestyle that the end result is not because is not playing softball better or, you know, flag football. It's to have your physique. So that's your sport. You're working on your physique and you can still have a life. So this is something that I think that guys gravitate to, you know, right after high school or college. What are they going to do after organized sport?
Right. Well, yeah, you're right on. I mean, I've been a physique athlete for 19, 20 years now, working towards it, not realizing that I had a place, an outlet, because bodybuilding wasn't for me. I'm like, yeah, it's not really my thing. But when this came up, I said, oh, okay. So there are a ton of us guys that are just, it's like, oh, okay, there is a place I can play my game. And that is the physique. But back to, I guess, Zane's talk about the shorts. Now, obviously, the majority of our legs are covered up during the contest as they are. But one area that we still have showing during any given contest are the calves. So I'd like to talk to you just a little bit and for our listeners about calf development. Because a lot of people say, oh, it's a genetic muscle. And then because of that, they give up on it. Now, what do you think?
Well, I think that certainly you can have get dealt a bad hand genetically. However, you can get a bad hand in any body part. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I see with calf development or calf training is, well, a couple. One is it became kind of like it's an add-on. In other words, it became like ab training. I'm going to train and then I'll just finish with some abs. I'll train and then every other day I'll finish with calves. So, you know, you should go in and say, I'm going to destroy my calves. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of ways where you can get a better contraction. And then you can start to see if, you know, you can develop the muscle tissue that you have there. A lot of guys, I think it's because it's such an afterthought. That it gets, you know, they think I'm doing it more frequently, like every other day and stuff. And I did all that. And I just found that if I treat it like a regular body part, it was a lot better. And that's how I treat all the body parts now. I don't like, if you're going to train abs, you set aside time to train them.
Yeah. You know, and it's after training for a number of years now, I was originally thinking, well, the calves are what they're going to be. But especially this last, I would say roughly about the last year, I decided I would no longer accept the idea that it was not possible and that it was entirely possible. Now, of course, you know, having a higher calf, you're not going to have the long belly that comes down to your ankle, developing into a cankle, perhaps. But you don't want those anyway. You trip on them. But once I decided that was not a limitation I was willing to accept, and this goes for everyone, once you decide you're not willing to accept that as a limitation, but instead a challenge that you're going to overcome, you will see those results because you'll find ways to get there. And that's what I found. You talk about a peak contraction. And then one thing I enjoy, I guess is kind of a sick way to put it, but the pain, like the stretch, the pre-stretch going into each movement. And I've found over the last year, I've made some significant improvements with these principles. And most of that comes back to the mindset.
I agree. I mean, I have my weakness was always my arms compared to other body parts. And so, you know, I had to get serious about figuring out how to train my arms. And so... You can sit there and go, it's not working. But then if you really break it down, you can get more out of it. You really can. I mean, and you know, there's like this, I see, I think even recently I've seen a couple of people go, well, you know, that the contraction, if you don't feel the motion, then that's nonsense. Because if you didn't feel it or you weren't getting a contraction, the weight wouldn't move. And it's like, well, that's true. The weight does move, but part of displaying your physique is having control over your nervous system. And right. if you can't think about contracting a muscle with or without weight, you can't display it. It's just not going to happen. And that's why you see some of these guys that have like crazy separation. They do a front raise and their front delt pops out. Okay, they do a rear delt, and their rear delt pops out. They don't just have a massive deltoid. There's a difference.
Right, it's the mind-muscle connection and understanding what muscle group is moving your skeletal structure in which fashion. And I mean, moving a weight is one thing, but when you take and look at your skeletal structure and seeing what is actually moving during that exercise, that's how you're going to learn to really isolate the right muscle.
Yeah, and so, you were talking about this pre-stretch. I was going to say, if you want to start at any part of the rep and get the most mileage, it's the negative, and you know that. You really have to focus on that, and that includes body parts like abs and calves. Sometimes I see guys doing calves, and they're just bouncing up and down, and there's no descent where they defy gravity, and that's a big problem. Because that's where you get most of your satellite cell stimulation.
Yes.
And so it kind of goes to, I got the weight up and I got X amount of reps, but did you really damage the fiber?
Right. Well, so just for our listeners here, if we can get your three tips, because I don't know that everybody has seen your calves, but those things are ridiculous. It's like you have two grapefruits tied to each leg. So, I mean, why don't you tell us what your three, if you had three tips to give to our listeners, what you do for calves?
Well, I thank you for the compliment. I've already told you it's largely genetics, but there's definitely some training techniques that I believe have done a whole lot for me. And the first one is when you do it's kind of a modified, almost a jump calf raise. And basically, if you're in a calf, standing calf machine, you would straighten out your legs on the negative. So you get that full calf stretch, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. right? But as you're driving up, if you bend your knees slightly and act like you're jumping, because that's how you really contract your calves, is by jumping. You know, you don't try to touch the rim on a basketball court flat-footed. You bend your knees. So the first tip would be make sure your knees are locked on the negative as you come down. And it takes a little practice, but when you're coming up, you can bend your knees slightly and you drive up as if you, you know, we're trying to jump through the ceiling. And you'll notice yourself getting a much better contraction. And as and when you're at the top, then you just straighten your knees out and go descend. And so you get that full stretch, and then you get a really nice contraction on the way up.
Excellent.
And the other thing is, I would say, for me, the super low reps never did anything. I always like to, even more so nowadays, stay in 6 to 12. And so that's one thing is, I know there was a, has been, you know, do super amount of reps or do very, very low reps. I know Arnold used to say, you know, you stack the thing up and do just a few reps. And I think that that just makes it so you can't drive up all the way and get a contraction, a full contraction. So I would say stay in a, what's considered a moderate rep range, but get the work done. So you're going to want to do at least five sets of calves and probably work your way up to 10 sets of calves.
And so, how many exercises are you doing there? Are you doing two, three?
I do 2 to 3. And, okay. And so here's another. So, okay. So if you're doing, you get up to that much work or volume, you notice you're not going to be able to do calves every other day because they're going to be fried. So that helps because now you can, you know, do them every third or fourth day like you would do your, train your legs, or maybe every fifth day, which is what I do. And then the other thing is that if you have trouble with your calves, even more so than, you know, you think the average bear does, cut the movements down. In other words, I hear a lot of guys go, I did like four different movements. You know, I did it on the leg press. I did standing. I did seated. I did, you know, the old, you know, guy gets on your back and you do donkey calf
raises. Yeah, donkey style, yeah.
You know, there's the technique called German volume training, which is basically you take less movements and you do more sets. So go to 8 to 10 sets of one movement, and that damages the fiber in that range of motion better than picking 3 or 4 movements.
That's great.
Or 2 or 3.
Okay, so I mean, there's some good information there for everybody listening. It sounds like you're really preferring quality over quantity. Now, the German volume training, there is quantity of sets, but still it's quality in a couple exercises per workout.
Right. When you start going to out past 6-7 sets for one movement, you got to pare it down to maybe one movement. I mean, the typical 10 sets of 10, or Vince Gerona had 8 sets of 8, and he would say you pick one movement, that's it, and you just bury it. And that's you'll notice you get so much more deep tissue soreness than you would if you do the typical 3 or 4 movements and you do 3 or 4 sets. It's just, it's amazing how much more tissue gets activated because, you know, you're doing set after set and cumulatively the, you know, the damage is just really crazy.
Great.
It's another way to specialize as well.
I specialize in the area, right? All right, well, that's some great stuff there, some good tips and some workout advice to try for our listeners. Please stay tuned. Thanks for joining us so far. We have Bobby Ashurst, one of the first IFBB Men's Physique pros waiting. We're going to bring him in and interview him. And he has a lot of things going on, including a move to LA. So we're going to talk to him about that here right after this break.
Fusion Bodybuilding makes bodybuilding's strongest supplements, and they're committed to giving back to you. Fusion Bodybuilding not only want to promote the bodybuilding lifestyle, but they also want to help build the sport. Bodybuilding is all they do. It's their obsession. You know the feeling. That's why you're here. Visit Fusion Bodybuilding at FusionBodybuilding.com or join in on the conversation on the Fusion Bodybuilding fan page on Facebook, where you'll find IFBB Pro Q&As, contest giveaways, and nothing but in-depth bodybuilding talk. Fusion Bodybuilding, bodybuilding's strongest supplements. Head over to FusionBodybuilding.com today. On
March 17, 2012, St. Patrick's Day weekend, First Form and Hydralyze Ultra present the First Form Pro Women's Physique, Fitness, and Bikini Championship, along with the First Form NPC Midwest Bodybuilding, Fitness, Figure, Physique, Bikini, and Men's Physique Championship, a national qualifier. This event has so many perks for both athletes and fans alike. Just ask the over 1,300 guests that attended last year's event. Taking place at the St. Louis University Bush Student Center, you'll watch IFBB Pro and future superstar Mike Liberatore and current IFBB Pro superstar Kai Green as they light up the stage with their posing routines. Six-time fitness Olympia Adela Garcia will be in attendance. The top male and female pros and top amateurs from across the country are coming to St. Louis. Plus, the RX Muscle Model Search is taking place. Here's your chance to win some great prizes, get a photo shoot, and also be featured on RXMuscle.com. Come meet the top supplement companies in attendance at their booths with free samples. March 17th, 2012 in St. Louis, Missouri. All contest information can be found at NPCMidwest.com, including tickets and prices. Don't miss it. Go to NPCMidwest.com for all information.
P28 High Protein Bread is the official bread of RX Muscle. Are you looking to incorporate more protein into your meals or just want to enjoy bread again? Then look no further. Try the 100% natural P28 High Protein Bread. P28 High Protein Bread is a formulated revolutionary breakthrough product packed with whey protein isolate, 14 grams of protein per slice, 12 grams of carbs, 8 essential amino acids, and made with 100% whole wheat. Fear bread no more. Build a better body with P28. Order today at highproteinbread.com. P28 is also now available at bodybuilding.com and many other retailers. Order now, highproteinbread.com. P28 Bread, RX Muscle approved.
Out on the edge of fitness and endurance, there's a line. It's where winners and losers are defined. That's the narrow place where Gamma O gives the serious competitor the extra step. That extra kick nobody knew was there. Gamma O raises your testosterone level naturally and legally. So before you step up to the line one more time, be prepared to bring it with Gamma O, the all-natural testosterone booster. Gamma O is available nationwide at General Nutrition Centers or on the web at GammaO.com.
RXMuscle.com. Now you have a place to turn when you want the truth on bodybuilding, diet, and exercise. Up-to-the-minute news and more. Visit the RXMuscle.com forums featuring celebrity Q&As with IFBB professional athletes, top amateurs, and the brightest minds in the industry. Listen to our weekly radio shows, including Heavy Muscle Radio, Muscle Girls Inc., After Hours, and more. Contest coverage, videos, even our own social networking site, RX Muscle Place. Visit RXMuscle.com.
And welcome back to Physique Star Radio. We're your hosts, Vince Andrich, and I'm Ian Lauer. We're bringing on Bobby Ashurst. He is one of the first IFBB men's physique pros. How are you today, Bobby?
I'm good. How about you guys?
Great. Great. Thanks for joining us.
So, great to have you on, Bobby.
I appreciate it. Congratulations, by the way, guys, for getting the radio station going.
We heard you were turning pro, so we figured we better get a station up so we can interview you.
I appreciate that. That's good looking out, buddy.
I mean, Vince called me up. He said, "Hey, let's get this done."
Leading the new revolution, the golden age, the new golden age, right?
Well, I call it the platinum era.
Absolutely.
So, we were just talking before you joined us about something that was in. Building the Body by Frank Zane is spring 2011 edition. And I wanted to read it to you because I know you have trouble reading if it's not a regular picture book. And
pop-up pictures.
Otherwise,
I lose interest. Tab.
A little scratch and sniff by Zane. But so I'm just going to read you this, and I just want to get your thoughts on it because Vince and I already had a lengthy discussion, and we're curious as to what you think.
All right.
So if you're ready.
I am ready.
All right, here it is. Another wrong turn in bodybuilding is the physique division recently added to the contests. Everything bodybuilding argued that it was not, this is times 10. Bodybuilding said it was not a beauty contest, but a sport. That posing was a way to display development, not just prancing around showing off. But that is exactly what is done in the physique division. No standard poses, just walking around looking cutie. And best of all, they wear knee-length board shorts. No need for uncomfortable leg workouts. So, That's right out of his spring edition for Building the Body. I know how I took it. What are your thoughts?
I mean, everyone has their opinion. I mean, Frank Zane, obviously his career speaks for himself. But I think, I personally completely disagree with his with his opinion in this situation. I mean, the fact is, men's physique competitors train just as hard and diet just as hard as any bodybuilder I know out there. So the fact that they keep complaining that, you know, we got to wear board shorts, don't have to do leg workouts. Most of these guys are ex-bodybuilders with massive quads that would like to show them off, but, you know, we're not the ones that make the rules. We just compete according to the rules that are set for us.
Right. Well, you say, I hear a little anger in your voice there. Either someone stepped on your, can I say genitals? I think I already did. Or you're really upset about the Zane comment.
You know, like I said, I mean, we train and we are as dedicated as any bodybuilder. So for them to not give us the respect, to me, is just ridiculous. It's like, I don't see any men's physique competitors going around saying, oh, man, those bodybuilders are ridiculous. They got to wear those little shorts and they go around posing and this and that. It's like, we don't say that at all. Matter of fact, it's just right. The opposite. It's exactly right. The opposite. We say we have nothing but respect because we know the kind of work it takes to get to that level. And we do that. We put that same kind of effort in as well. So, I mean, all this negativity to me is just ridiculous. All this does, I mean, I hear the same thing about bikini as well. The same complaints. All this is growing the sport and growing the industry, bringing more people in it and making more people aware of what's going on. And all that's going to do is bring more money to it and more attention to everybody.
Yeah, I think in the long run, everybody wins. It gives more people that want to compete a chance to compete. And I think as the division goes along, it will hopefully gain more and more respect from those strictly adhering to the bodybuilding lifestyle versus another, like the physique lifestyle. Now, Vince, you did a lot of bodybuilding in the past, and you and I discussed before the difference in like a bulking phase and having to diet down for a bodybuilding show versus living the physique lifestyle year round. So I don't know, how do you feel? Are you with Bobby on the idea that it's as hard to train from physique?
I think it's harder. I mean, yeah. I came from an era where if you didn't bulk up, there was a period of time where guys are like, well, you know, why are you so tight on your diet? And I, you know, arguably compared to now, back then I was bulkier, but compared to guys, even then, I was nowhere near it. They were 40 pounds heavier than me. I mean, now they'd be 80 pounds heavier. You know, I competed at 198, and I would get up to about 214. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder. I mean, the guys that think that training to enter a physique show, it's still bodybuilding. It's different rules.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
If you never tried to get an inch on your arms, like I told you, I think last week, you know, if you've never really dieted, then you can make these comments, okay? Mm-hmm. But you know, there's plenty of guys out there that rely too heavily on the pharmacology of this whole thing, and I think they're the ones that need to like get with the program and start training harder because they don't realize how hard it is.
If you're not introducing GH into your body, you're just running naturally. It's a little different ball game to get that conditioning and that size.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, these guys say that we don't train as hard. Like I said, we train just as hard. We just not pumping 12 different chemical compounds in on a weekly basis. So I mean, there's only so much you can do naturally.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that you know, division stays clean. I mean, I believe that's one of the big pushes and why the NPC, it seems like, was, you know, excited to get this thing going is to clean the sport up and give those of us that are clean a chance to really get up there and compete competitively. And this goes back to what you and I were saying, Vince, about the difference in, you know, bodybuilding versus physique, and it goes back to that.
Well, I was reading some stuff on your site, Bobby, and you have this golden age of men's physique, and you're talking about the camaraderie that was back in the day. And I think there was a lot of camaraderie back then. And from what I understand, there's a tremendous amount of camaraderie between the physique guys. It's not this hater group.
That's a really good group.
And it really, you know, around the mid-80s, it started, bodybuilding became the haters. It's like, oh, that guy doesn't have calves, and that guy does. You can't compete here because, you know, you moved out of town for 6 months. It's like, come on. It's like it went to pieces. And the other thing is, then the diversity of physiques made it, I'm an aesthetic bodybuilder, let's say, and the other guy's a big, real bodybuilder, quote unquote, right? Because you had a Zane and a Nibray versus an Arnold, or somebody else, that, you know, Lou Ferrigno. So you had a range. You had Robbie Robinson, like you mentioned. There was a range of physique, so you could be individual and still be on the same stage. The individuality went away with bodybuilding, and then it became cutthroat. It's like, okay, we all have to look like Branch Warren, so I'm going to be Branch Warren. There's no individuality, and I think this is why physique has taken off, and just another reason why.
The individuality just sprung a thought of a Bobby on stage. I don't remember if it was Muscle Contest or which show it was in Culver City, but I'm going to have to call back the old interview we did with Bobby a while back, where he has this certain sachet about his walk and turns. So though Zane may not be a big fan of Bobby's posing and maneuverability from one move to the next, Bobby, you have a way about you on stage.
Well, I mean, I think that's, I mean, in talking to judges, one of the things that I did throughout this entire season, so if you notice, my physique has changed throughout the season, as well as my posing has changed throughout the season. So I talk to judges after every single show. Mm-hmm. And so I adjusted everything based on what the judges were looking for. Now, the fact that some judges like a little personality and some like you just to go up there and hit your pose, I mean, I still try to put my own individual swing on or on the way I present myself on stage versus just going up there and just getting lost in the crowd. Like I've had Sandy Williamson in the last communication we had, one of the last things she left off with saying is that stage presence is one of the biggest parts. It's probably more important in men's physique than many of the other categories. And I think a lot of guys miss that point. Mm-hmm. So like I said, I mean, everybody on stage, when you get to a competition, everybody's in shape, everybody looks good, but there's many people that have absolutely no stage presence. When you see them backstage, I see them all the time, like, man, that guy looks amazing. Then you see him on stage, he just disappears in the background and doesn't stand out. And I think that's where stage presence makes a difference. And that's where that individuality, whatever your type of individuality is, can win or lose a show for you.
Well, you might as well take that chance. I mean, it comes down to, first off, you're taking a chance by stepping on stage. It's going to bruise your ego if you don't win. But, you just have to go beyond that and just do it. And taking that chance on stage, though can be uncomfortable at times, it is a way to differentiate yourself and hopefully, pull that win.
Oh, absolutely.
But, and just for our listeners and, we don't time travel here. We are recording on Monday and you'll hear this on Thursday. But in the meantime, what's going to happen is Bobby is putting on a posing clinic. So you'll hear this after it's all said and done. So Bobby, but I know you'll do more in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about your posing clinic?
Well, in going to shows that I didn't compete at, two of the things I've actually been asked about the most was, number one, from other competitors, asked if I would do a posing clinic because for whatever reason, I don't know if maybe it's the little hip swing thing or whatever I do.
I think it's the way you carry your purse. I think it's the way you carry your purse.
So whatever it is, it seems to stand out to other competitors, and they, they sort of felt like I was the one that they wanted to have teach them how to present themselves best on stage. So they asked me to do that. And the other part that I get asked the most about is marketing. So I decided rather than do just a standard posing clinic, it's not the most novel idea in the world. I mean, people have been doing it forever. I decided to partner up with, some photographers and some friends that I know who have actually been in the fitness industry for a while and actually had some success, and also do a piece on marketing yourself as a fitness model. Because, competing is fine. I mean, it's a great hobby, but at the end of the day, everybody, like most people have aspirations to be some sort of fitness personality, but most people have absolutely no idea how to get there. So that's going to be the whole point of these clinics that we're going to attempt to do throughout the country this season. So we'll have a part on marketing as well as help people with presentation on the stage as well. So that they'll be better prepared both on and off stage for success within this industry.
Well, that's great. You know, and a lot of guys may not necessarily want to go into to show business per se, but they may want to do get into magazines or even just improve their personal training business. And these same tools, I'm imagining that you're teaching for getting into fitness modeling gigs would also apply to improving your public perception for personal training. I mean, some of these guys are personal trainers. Would that be true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, competing, getting in, getting published in magazines, getting put in an ad, all things involved. I mean, it just shows if you're just a personal trainer, it shows your clients that you actually live the lifestyle that you're trying to preach to them.
Right.
That's not going to do anything but edify you as a personal trainer.
Well, it sounds like your goals there are right along the lines of Physique Star Radio, because we want to help these guys get prepped and ready for shows and have the physique they want, but also learn what to do with the physique once they have it. So it sounds like it's right along the same lines.
So, I think that's the, like you guys discussed earlier about the camaraderie within Men's Physique as well as the blog that I put out there. I mean, that's kind of the exciting part about it. It's so new. There's so much stuff that we could actually do if somebody just takes the initiative to do it. And I'm not the type of person to sit there and talk about stuff. I almost never talk about stuff. I just do stuff. You know, and things work out the way they work out.
Bobby, right. I really appreciate that. And one of the things I grabbed from what you just mentioned about the getting somebody ready for their stage presence and then also the ability to market themselves comes down to charisma. And then the other things you can't see when a certain trainer walks in a room, you know it when you see it. You know it when you see it on stage. And, you know, you're teaching these people that what they have as far as a physique, in my view, is art. And if you're not proud of your art, then, you know, you probably should just be a wallflower.
Yeah.
And you know, you're a leader. And that's what this whole thing needs, is people not waiting to be picked, but saying, I deserve to be out there because I can put myself out there. No one's going to pick you and make you the guy. Those days are over. You got to make yourself. And yeah, so what you're doing is awesome.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the thing is, I always tell people, it's like, if you don't believe that you can be whoever you want to be, then why would anybody else believe it? So, that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of people who say, it's like, oh, I want to be an actor. Oh, I want to get on the cover of Men's Health. Oh, I want to do this. But they never do anything about it but tell people that's what they want to do. Sometimes you just got to go out there and do it.
Well, you know what? And you make a great point, and you do have to believe in yourself. And that is the biggest challenge for most people. You see the covers, you see the editorials, you know, this and that, and you think, oh, that would be great. But you really don't believe that you can get there. But there are ways to get there and ways to help push yourself there. But you're right. It comes back to believing that you can do it. Because once you really believe you can, you'll notice that everybody else will start to believe too.
Absolutely. I mean, just confidence like that just shines through. And it's the same thing with on the stage. Actually, I had a guy actually come into my store in Arizona and mentioned it to me. Went to my website, looked at the pictures, competition pictures, and he came in and told me, he's like, you know, there's one thing I noticed about your pictures from your shows. It's that you're the only person on stage smiling as if you know some secret, as if you know some secret that they don't. And I told him, like, you know what, the thing is, I do know a secret. The secret is I actually have fun. I actually enjoy being out there. I'm confident with what I do, and it shines through on stage. And that once again goes back to stage presence. So, I mean, that confidence is contagious at anything you do in life.
Right. Well, taking those lessons and applying them elsewhere, yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. And that's one of the big benefits of doing this, as you say, as a hobby, because it can translate into all the other aspects of your life. And and I've told people, you know, the way I approach business is like I used to approach bodybuilding. You know, it's one rep at a time, man. You know, you set the goal and you go out and do the work. And,
absolutely.
You know, it's not insurmountable because you break it up into pieces. That's all. And it's a really good lesson for, you know, to be able to, you know, grab this kind of confidence and know that you can do it. And you're already finding it out. Once you know that this is like a secret weapon, man, it could really be a powerful thing for somebody that didn't really have it before.
Well, and that confidence really helps you take other steps you wouldn't necessarily take. Like, well, for instance, Bobby, you're back and forth a lot between Arizona and LA now, and it seems like you may be finding your way out here. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's the plan. So, like I said, I've been out here. I got booked for a movie earlier in the month, and then decided, you know, I'm just gonna stay out here for the month. Up until, since I have the posing clinic and LA Fit Expo that I have to work, I'm just gonna stay out here the month and see how much work I can actually book while I'm out here. And yeah, it's kind of been a little crazy. So I've done a lot more stuff. I feel like I've accomplished more in the 3 weeks here than I've probably accomplished in the last 6 months back in Arizona.
Yeah.
But, so
I mean,
so
it's. I'll go ahead. Sorry.
Oh yeah. So it definitely makes the move is definitely imminent.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, and that's really. I mean, it's great to hear that. And this is an example for our listeners of someone that is taking their physique and utilizing it in a way to push to somewhere that I'm guessing when you were 10 years old, you maybe thought you wanted to do a movie, but maybe didn't think it was possible. But now you've been able to find the resources and make it happen partially because of what you've done with your physique.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's kind of odd. I remember I booked the first TV job I booked was based on my physique, yet I have yet to do a TV show or a movie where they actually had me take my shirt off. So,
wait,
so
wait, are you just going in there? Are you on the casting couch then? Is that what's going on?
No, nah, they were taking pictures. Now, they were taking headshots, and then they asked me.
What kind of movie is this?
You're on the fast track, Bobby.
No,
you wind up in like sometimes, they call that the valley out here in Chatsworth.
Hysterical.
Sometimes you got to pay certain prices to get where you want to get. I'm just kidding.
When you plan on moving? Are you going to move?
I still have a lease in Arizona until mid-March. So I'm probably going to be traveling a lot between now and then. So I imagine probably by mid-March. But I'll probably actually be spending the majority of my time, anytime I'm not actually on the road traveling for a competition or a posing clinic, I'm most likely going to be spending that time in L.A. anyway.
Great. Well, we'll see you over at Gold's. You know, we have to wrap this up here. Bobby, thanks so much for joining us today. And while I'm thinking of it, what is the URL of your posing clinic in case people want to check it out? Where can they find you?
Right now, it's www.mynutrafit.com. But I actually have Natalie Min. She started a web design company called Natalie Min Interactive. So they're finishing up my new site. It'll be called
prophysiqueprep.com. prophysiqueprep.com.
Yeah, so that should be done probably in the next week or two would be what I imagine.
Well, great. Again, thanks for joining us. We'll see you over at Gold's here shortly. Vince, any last words?
Oh, just congratulations, Bobby, for all your accomplishments, man. Look forward to seeing you probably at the Fit Expo.
And absolutely.
Yeah, I check that out and maybe see it down in Gold Venice.
Sounds like a plan. I appreciate you guys having me on today.
Thank you, Bobby. And to our listeners, thanks so much for joining us here at Physique Star Radio. Come back and visit us again soon. And make sure you stay tuned because Dr. Connolly is going to be talking with some big words of extreme intelligence, and Dave is going to do his best to interpret them for everyone.
Muscle University.
Fusion Bodybuilding makes bodybuilding's strongest supplements, and they're committed to giving back to you. Fusion Bodybuilding not only want to promote the bodybuilding lifestyle, but they also want to help build the sport. Bodybuilding is all they do. It's their obsession. You know the feeling. That's why you're here. Visit Fusion Bodybuilding at FusionBodybuilding.com or join in on the conversation on the Fusion Bodybuilding fan page on Facebook, where you'll find IFBB Pro Q&As, contest giveaways, and nothing but in-depth bodybuilding talk. Fusion Bodybuilding, bodybuilding's strongest supplements. Head over to FusionBodybuilding.com today. On March
March 17, 2012, St. Patrick's Day weekend, First Form and Hydralyze Ultra present the First Form Pro Women's Physique, Fitness, and Bikini Championship, along with the First Form NPC Midwest Bodybuilding, Fitness, Figure, Physique, Bikini, and Men's Physique Championship, a national qualifier. This event has so many perks for both athletes and fans alike. Just ask the over 1,300 guests that attended last year's event. Taking place at the St. Louis University Bush Student Center, you'll watch IFBB Pro and future superstar Mike Liberatore and current IFBB Pro superstar Kai Green as they light up the stage with their posing routines. Six-time Fitness Olympia Adela Garcia will be in attendance. The top male and female pros and top amateurs from across the country are coming to St. Louis. Plus, the RX Muscle Model Search is taking place. Here's your chance to win some great prizes, get a photo shoot, and also be featured on RXMuscle.com. Come meet the top supplement companies in attendance at their booths with free samples. March 17th, 2012 in St. Louis, Missouri. All contest information can be found at NPCMidwest.com, including tickets and prices. Don't miss it. Go to NPCMidwest.com for all information.
B28 High Protein Bread is the official bread of RX Muscle. Are you looking to incorporate more protein into your meals or just want to enjoy bread again? Then look no further. Try the 100% natural P28 High Protein Bread. P28 High Protein Bread is a formulated revolutionary breakthrough product. Packed with whey protein isolate, 14 grams of protein per slice, 12 grams of carbs, 8 essential amino acids, and made with 100% whole wheat. Fear bread no more. Build a better body with P28. Order today at highproteinbread.com. P28 is also now available at bodybuilding.com and many other retailers. Order now. Highproteinbread.com. P28 bread. RX Muscle approved.
Out on the edge of fitness and endurance, there's a line. It's where winners and losers are defined. That's the narrow place where Gamma O gives the serious competitor the extra step. That extra kick nobody knew was there. Gamma O raises your testosterone level naturally and legally. So before you step up to the line one more time, be prepared to bring it with Gamma O, the all-natural testosterone booster. Gamma O is available nationwide at general nutrition centers or on the web at GammaO.com.
RxMuscle.com. Now you have a place to turn when you want the truth on bodybuilding, diet, and exercise. Up-to-the-minute news and more. Visit the RxMuscle.com forums featuring celebrity Q&As with IFBB professional athletes, top amateurs, and the brightest minds in the industry. Listen to our weekly radio shows including Heavy Muscle Radio, Muscle Girls Inc., After Hours, and more. Contest coverage, videos, even our own social networking site, RX Muscle Place. Visit RxMuscle.com. Now, it's time for Muscle University Radio with Dave Palumbo and Dr. Scott Connolly.
Welcome to another edition of Muscle University. I'm Dave Palumbo, and I'm here with Dr. Scott Connolly, the owner of Myotropics Physique Nutrition. And Scott, this week's topic is going to be something that has had a lot of debate out in the bodybuilding domain, as well as the general public domain. It's blood sugar control and, you know, what we can do to optimize it, what's dangerous, and what are some of the things we should look out for. Now, maybe it would be good for you to start off with just explaining exactly some of the control mechanisms that the body exhibits to have a tight control of blood glucose.
Sure. Obviously, from our previous discussions, the control of blood glucose level is a preeminent, you know, priority signaling mechanism extant in the body of all mammals, because obviously there's a very, you know, low tolerance for excursions into particularly the low range where you get immediate symptomatology, primarily referencing the target organ where glucose is, you know, critical, and that's the central nervous system. So there are many counter-regulatory mechanisms extant in the body that immediately are called upon or recruited when the blood glucose level starts to fall below a certain, you know, critical lower limit. And, you know, the more well-known of those are all of the engagement mechanisms that are essentially signaled into action by release of the preeminent counter-regulatory hormone to insulin, which is glucagon. And then there's a host and a cascade of sort of neuroendocrine responses that follow sequentially upon the primary release of glucagon, all of which are designed to restore the blood glucose level back up to the minimal level where central nervous system function can be maintained.
So basically, Scott, insulin lowers blood sugar by pushing the glucose into the cells. And then if blood glucose needs to go up, there's other, you know, hormones like glucagon, which can raise blood glucose. Cortisol can raise blood glucose via, you know, gluconeogenesis reactions in the liver. And so there's this balance essentially between these two ups and downs.
Right. What is not appreciated, Dave, by the average person, even, you know, sort of like the nutritional enthusiast that a lot of our audience consider themselves to be a part of, is the fact that because of the criticality of glucose control and the central nervous system functionality as a result of tight control, there are actually an almost unfathomable number of nodal points of control that are essentially interrelated with one another in a very tight network of signaling and, counter-regulation mechanisms for excursions of glucose up and down, mostly down, as we've talked about. But some of these things are really pretty fascinating. And, for example, in the human, the start of glucose signaling actually begins in the oral cavity. And there are a series of very discrete receptors that are found in high density in the back of the hypopharynx or the back of the throat in humans that actually can sense, you know, different proteins and their constitutive amino acid arrays. There are generally two classes of these receptors that essentially signal by way of enteric to brain, or, you know, as broader term, gut to brain afferent, or, you know, feed forward signalings to the central nervous system. And these are all carried by branches of the vagus nerve, a preeminent traffic pathway of information for the parasympathetic nervous system. These receptors, as I said, are actually extant in the posterior part of your oral cavity, and they continue all the way down into the large bowel, so the very large bowel in its full extent in humans. And the density and complexity of these receptor networks beginning in the mouth that actually sense the delivery of glucose-containing nutrients plays a preeminent role in setting the stage for an appropriate distribution algorithm.
Now I want to just ask you one thing, Scott, because this is interesting. This is something that I'm not even that aware of, and I'm sure some of our listeners might be interested. Can sugar substitutes like Splenda and Equal, can they stimulate the same vagus nerve response, or is it specifically, you know, like sugar molecules that do this?
Well, some of the receptors that have been characterized, Dave, have response profiles that seem to skew to particular attributes of the compound that have a lot to do with their taste perception. So, for example, there are bitter receptors that are very active, and there are sort of sweet receptors that are very active. And the distinction is thought to underlie the principal, you know, sort of monitoring, gross monitoring status of an ingested, substance. An ingested substance can either be nutritional. So there are essentially spring-loaded mechanisms to kind of eject things that are potentially toxic that, instead of leading to the cascade of digestive phenomenon, lead to the activation of the central nervous system to engage and initiate vomiting. So there seems to be a sort of demarcation along the lines of bitter and sweet. And therefore, it's possible that some substances which are not nutritive per se, in other words, are not metabolizable to individual constituents that can then be used for storage or oxidation, could excite through these sort of taste receptors afferent signals to the central nervous system. But not a lot is known about that, obviously, because this is pretty esoteric stuff. Mm-hmm. But as I said, the interesting facet of this that, you know, is really pretty evident when you start to take a look at the actual science is that the extent and sort of scope or precision involved in the glucose regulatory pathways and their interaction with lipid and amino acid metabolism is, as I said, really almost unfathomable. There's just so many crosstalk pathways that exist that, prepare the body for different exigencies, whether that be an enhancement of gluconeogenesis, as would be the case in a, prolonged fast or a starvation, challenge, or the use of amino acids for some emergency high priority signal from the body. All of this, as I keep, you know, trying to emphasize, is set against the backdrop that the irreducible component of absolute control is glucose. And that, you know, kind of all skews back to the discussion about the mechanisms that can modulate blood glucose responses. So one of the things that, you know, people should be aware of is that the composition of the diet, especially the composition of the agents that can primarily affect glucose digestive processes, and those would be, you know, either rapidly available or slowly available carbohydrate sources and proteins primarily, because obviously, as you know, a large component of the amino acid intake of the diet is ultimately used to convert into glucose molecules.
Sure.
So all attributes of, you know, a particular foodstuff, its solubility, its, you know, acid-base status, all aspects of the food compound in its an intact form can ultimately influence the response of these monitoring systems to an ingested meal. One of the interesting aspects of this that's, again, frequently overlooked is that the intestinal tract is the largest endocrine organ in the body, and it is capable of monitoring and secreting a host of different active, you know, polypeptide substances that have very profound effects on the distribution and utilization of ingested nutrients. And many of these play very critical roles in the maintenance of glucose homeostasis at the whole body level. And they're priming by these afferent messages that are sent all along the length of the gastrointestinal tract back to the areas in the hypothalamus of the brain that then can send, you know, command messages down by way of sympathetic outflow tracts to affect, you know, distribution, uptake, et cetera, are all integrated into a gigantic matrix of, you know, modulation of that all important six carbon molecule that we know as glucose.
Now, what I guess influences, okay, in an individual person dictate whether a person handles the glucose properly and modulates this response properly and doesn't modulate it properly? Because obviously there's people that tend to run blood sugars that are more normal and low normal, and then there's people who run blood sugars that are higher normal, and then there's people that obviously have high blood sugar that obviously requires addressing because it's going to cause a disease state. What dictates these? Is it the foods we eat? Is it the environment? Is it genetics? Or is it a combination?
Well, it's a combination for sure, Dave. However, obviously, the sort of, you know, commander in chief of this whole circus of, you know, orchestrated acts and events is the hormone insulin. So from the standpoint of a preeminent point of absolute control, obviously the dynamics of insulin's action at the tissue level is a very, very critical component. And what we know about insulin is the following, that insulin can have a range of effectiveness based not only on the amount of the stuff floating around, but also the tissue react, the molecules that are present in the plasma. And that's the sort of insulin sensitivity / resistance continuum. And the fact is that in human beings where, you know, large sample sizes have been studied from different, you know, ethnic groups and various parts of the world, it's clear that the range of this insulin sensitivity or responsiveness to an ingested glucose load primarily in terms of its disposal varies over a wide range. In fact, numbers quoted by people who are considered world, you know, experts in this area usually talk in the range of 6 to 8-fold differences between individuals. And that's obviously a heritable trait. And It might, in fact, stem from the fact that humans, obviously, over the period of the of their evolutionary development right up to the late Paleolithic, where, you know, the progression of the physiologic and anatomic form of humans became somewhat, you know, static. We are not necessarily in any way significantly different from a late Paleolithic era human walking around the planet 50,000 years ago. So what that means is that, you know, the various climate conditions in which those people we're living and thriving, which include, you know, the extremes all the way from equatorial regions where, you know, natural carbohydrate, plant and fruit, foodstuffs were available in some, you know, abundance, perhaps seasonally, but nonetheless, they were certainly more prevalent than the humans who made their way up to the circumpolar areas of Alaska and Greenland and were, you know, living on snow cones and seal blubber for the greater part of a million plus years. So that backdrop of, you know, a latitude sort of influenced dietary carbohydrate availability, no doubt influenced at a very profound genetic level the sensitivity of various human populations on the planet, you know, 50,000 years ago, who were subjected to a natural environment that was either replete with potential available carbohydrate for the diet or, you know, completely absent, you know, no carbohydrate really on any regular basis. That would obviously skew towards rather, you know, dramatic differences in the body's response to available insulin, because essentially, you know, again, this preeminent requirement of the central nervous system is invariant. It doesn't change. So me or the competition for other large disposal sources of, or disposal depots, I should say, for glucose, which in the human are essentially muscle being, you know, a gigantic one, fat being a gigantic competitor, and liver and to some extent kidney as well. All these organs have to have some kind of crosstalk or some kind of communication network, because at the end of the day, the boys upstairs, the central nervous system, you know, department gets, you know, X amount, and everybody else has to make do. So that would obviously mandate a very precise cross communication network between organs. And the inter-organ exchange of glucose, particularly the production of glucose, is fastidiously maintained by a host of, you know, small signaling molecules that have their effects at the DNA level of the cells that, you know, are doing the job of making the regulation work. And in fact, you know, that's one of the reasons that probably people do have, to a certain extent anyway, a genetic predisposition to become insulin resistant under the conditions of a typical Western high carbohydrate diet, whereas other people may not. In fact, some very interesting observations many years ago, and these are things that are, you know, part of my collection of inconvenient truths when people talk about this, is that, you know, it's actually been replicated a couple, two, three times that individuals who are characterized as relatively insulin sensitive or relatively insulin resistant by the usual sort of whole body crude methods that are applied to basically, you know, which is the response to an oral glucose challenge test with, you know, timed measurements of glucose in the blood to see how fast it goes away. And when you do that with people at birth and you can sort of characterize them as being relatively insulin sensitive or relatively insulin resistant, which means after you feed them some glucose source, it either goes away fast or it doesn't go away fast, basically what that means. People who are sensitive tend not to become diabetic. And you kind of make sense of that because you'd say, well, diabetes is too much glucose in your blood. So if somebody's sensitive to a dietary load and they get rid of it, they clear it, then they're unlikely to have, you know, residual plasma levels that would lead to them being classified as diabetic or pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. The individuals who are insulin resistant from birth tend to become diabetic over time if they are exposed to the usual and customary high percentage of rapidly available carbohydrate that constitutes 50 to 60% of the typical Western diet nowadays. What's interesting is that the insulin sensitive people tend to become obese. The two intersect at a point where the obese person, by virtue of the fact that they continue to get obese and their insulin levels continue to rise, the people who are insulin resistant tend to resist becoming obese, but they're the ones who stand the greatest, you know, chance of becoming a diabetic. And this clearly, you know, demarcates the distinction between the, you know, obesity and diabetes continuum, because you know, it's not true that, you know, obesity invariably leads to a type 2 diabetic state. Can it? Yes. And the mechanism is presumably related to the fact that as you become progressively more and more overfat or obese, the serum insulin response follows in step to a limited degree up to the point where the pancreatic islet cells, or the beta cells of the pancreas, which are responsible for manufacturing and secreting insulin, become burned out. And by become burned out, I mean just that. I mean they become essentially extinct. As you mentioned in a conversation we had, you know, earlier, the beta cell of the pancreas is rather sensitive to, you know, undue stress. And because of the obvious genetic differences that exist amongst human beings currently on the planet with respect to the ability of pancreatic beta cells to do their job, either very, very efficiently or not so efficiently, then obviously the stresses of a ever-increasing challenge by the diet to dispose of more and more and more dietary glucose can lead to a beta cell that essentially becomes, you know, just a burned out shell of itself and actually undergoes the typical cellular progression to what's called apoptosis or cell death.
Right. And I just want to interrupt you for a quick second, Scott, because also the studies have shown actually now that high blood glucose levels, even high normal, have even been shown to just directly kill the cells without even causing them to burn out, which, you know, I'm seeing in clients and people are contacting me. I'm talking about professional bodybuilders. I'm talking about top level athletes that are becoming, in a sense, type 1.5 diabetics, they're calling them, because they're requiring some insulin use because their pancreas just can't keep up with this. Obviously, this is a phenomenon in some of this percentage of population, like you said, that has trouble with disposing of glucose. What is a person, an athlete, to do in this situation to prevent this from occurring?
Well, I guess it's important to, you know, kind of, you know, state up front that if we're talking about a, you know, a competitive bodybuilder who is, you know, engaged in pharmacologic use, right, with agents that are known to have effects on, you know, the insulin glucose axis, that, you know, a component of their difficulty has to be essentially viewed as partially due at least to the pharmacology of the stuff they're taking. So a person who's taking, for example, super therapeutic levels of, say, for example, growth hormone, which has known effects on this particular, you know, axis of the body's control, would, you know, run the risk of having some problems with respect to the ultimate development of a dysregulated regulatory system. So that's a consideration that can't be dismissed in this context with an athlete who may be supplementing exercise with pharmaceuticals. The average person, however, obviously is confronted with this same problem, and it's a difficult problem because, as I said, the underlying data suggests very strongly that there's a huge variation in the susceptibility of people to a typical Western diet, where one person might, in fact, you know, go through their entire lifespan munching on 60%, you know, rapidly available carbohydrate sources and not have any problems. Another person might become a diabetic at half that level, and it's probably largely due to their intrinsic, you know, capabilities with respect to the overall regulation of the excursions of glucose in response to what, for all intents and purposes, if you compare it to our evolutionary heritage, is, you know, tidal waves of glucose. This is the problem that, and you mentioned that, you know, there's some people who seemingly become, you know, symptomatic at levels of glucose that are not considered in the charts in the textbook as pathologic. Well, the problem is with all blood levels, they're based on sort of a spurious assumption that just because, you know, there's this thing called statistics with a standard, you know, a normal distribution and standard deviations and things like that, that represents, you know, what really is, from an evolutionary perspective, normal. So if you compare our blood glucose norms in a Western population that's largely, you know, sort of cosmopolitan to a hunter-gatherer population that's currently existing on the earth that, you know, does not have access to these kinds of carbohydrate foodstuffs, you find that their average blood glucose is, you know, very dramatic, and dramatically different than ours. So it's probably true that the numbers that are assigned to alarm bells in our current medical institutional environment are high, referable to what really is high from the standpoint of an evolutionary perspective, just because so many people are eating the same way. I mean, they're
eating. Well, so what you're saying is basically everyone most of the population is probably not eating well. They're eating too many grams of carbohydrates. What in your estimation is too much? What do you, if you were the Surgeon General, Scott, how would you set the standards? What would your recommendations be? And what type of carbohydrate sources would you like to see people consider?
Well, again, I would make very specific recommendations along the following lines of thought. And that is, one, again, people eat mixed meals. So clearly, one of the avenues to control this problem to at least a limited, albeit significant, extent is to think judiciously about what you're eating. And from that standpoint, we have to talk about the well-known, well-documented, and profound effects that co-ingestion of various different protein sources with carbohydrates can, how those, that combination, protein plus carbohydrate, can impact the post-meal glucose and insulin response. And a lot is known about that. I mean, obviously, there are protein sources from many different, sources on the earth. There's plants, there's, meat, there's dairy, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these proteins have attributes that are vastly different in composition and in digestibility, et cetera, et cetera. So one would like to have some idea about how to leverage the beneficial effect of combining protein and carbohydrate to lower postprandial insulin and glucose sources by way of always paying attention to have at least equal amounts of protein and carbohydrate. Mm. And obviously the carbohydrates that produce the rapid and dramatic excursions in insulin and glucose are what we call the high biological availability, or what most people call a high glycemic carbohydrate. These are the worst offenders in this category are the monosaccharides, obviously sucrose and fructose, and then the processed oligomers of glucose that, for all intents and purposes, have peripheral distribution and uptake dynamics that are equivalent to the monosaccharides, and they right. have to be dealt with in the same way. So one of the things that a person could look at is, are there distinct differences between protein sources as to the efficacy of this postprandial or post-meal ingestion glucose response? And the answer to that is unequivocally yes. And the first distinction is that the proteins that do the job the quickest are the proteins that are rapidly assimilated into the body. Therefore, they are typically soluble. And that gets us into the category in our culture of proteins that are either soy or milk derived, because those are really the fastest acting proteins in terms of uptake and distribution. The problem, of course, with fast acting proteins is that because the enormous demand for protein synthesis in the gut will remove many of the amino acids on a first pass. If they are given rapid access to them, a lot of the amino acids, with the exception of the branch chains, never make it past the splanchnic circulation. They get utilized in the intestine. And the branch chains are unusual because they escape that fate and they escape metabolism in the liver. And therefore, they are the ones that circulate to the periphery and are involved in some of the mechanisms that are thought to regulate the glucose response. One of the mechanisms is that amino acids in and of themselves stimulate a significant physiologic insulin response. They are what we call insulinotropic, and the branch chains are particularly insulinotropic from the standpoint of their ability to stimulate meaningful responses of insulin, which synergize intracellularly with the amino acid-induced activation of our friend mTOR, which obviously is our protein synthesis machinery.
Right.
And not only can they stimulate that directly, but they can come around a back through a back door and get at the insulin cascade through an intermediate that's basically the PKB. So
I don't want to get too technical because that's another whole conversation.
What I'm saying is that there are parallel tracks even within the cell that allow – amino acids to leverage their insulin stimulating effects, let's say it that way. So at the whole body level, they can stimulate beta cell release of insulin, and even intracellularly, there is an obvious and potent mechanism that allows amino acids to have sort of a 1-2 punch with respect to regulating growth responses in particular that acts through an intracellular insulin pathway. Let's put it that way.
Now, are all these mechanisms that you're talking about, is this part of the science of your new Physique 2.0 product?
One of the things that I've tried to do with the new product, Dave, is to recognize the importance of the contribution of the gut in all of this, you know, rigmarole. And that is to basically construct a protein that has attributes that are known to affect some of the more important gastrointestinal polypeptides that are known to have very critical impact on energy homeostasis. And you can't have an impact on energy homeostasis without, you know, a predominant effect on glucose regulation. Mm-hmm. And that the hormone, or I won't call it a hormone, but a hormone-like polypeptide that's, you know, manufactured and secreted in the gut in response to very sophisticated signaling network is called GLP-1. Probably heard of that.
Yes.
It's basically a compound that is referred to as glucagon-like peptide 1. And this particular polypeptide can be profoundly stimulated by certain proteins, and the characteristics of those proteins matter. It's more responsive to intact proteins than it is to their isolates or their individual hydrolysates. So in essence, with respect to, for example, milk proteins, dairy proteins, there's a spectrum of effect on blood glucose that varies from the intact, you know, complete dairy type proteins all the way down to the more fast acting whey proteins, all of which have a positive effect on this GLP-1 thing. But there's a dissociation of effectiveness such that the intact proteins have a much larger effect than the rapid acting whey proteins do. And that's important to understand because one of the aspects of controlling partitioning is to have an effect over time so that the integration of the areas under the curve for the growth influences, and obviously insulin is a component of that, have to do with effect over time. So growing muscle is not an instantaneous, time-limited process. It's a 24/7 right. process. And it's wise to address that with respect to the nutritional modulation tools that you throw at it. And so in my new product, I try to do that with the kinetics and the attributes of the protein sources that are included to get a protracted effect over time that is synergized by the carbohydrate moiety that I've put in there. And that comes from the realization that there are some important signaling events that can be engaged in the lower part of the intestine as opposed to the proximal small bowel and so forth. And those have to do with the intersection of the resistant starch metabolism to short chain fatty acid that occurs in response to the ingestion of an RS3 or 4 resistant starch.
And Scott, I want to let's tie this together because we're kind of running out of time. I want to just bring the point together that the product that you put together has the scientific backing that it's going to help not only you with muscle repair, but it's also going to modulate this insulin response so that you don't have the spiking blood sugars that we're concerned about. Is that accurate statement?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, the importance of consistency here can't be overemphasized. That's the reason that I've always, for the majority of my academic career, have been a proponent of engineered foods. That is, if you really want to engage the mechanisms that are available for positive modulation of anabolic processes and enhancement of fat oxidation as a primary energy store, then the consistency of the intake has to be addressed primarily. It's very difficult for the average person to not only be aware of the nuances of these different variables that can affect things pretty profoundly, especially if you look at them over time, and at the same time, you know, be able to execute a diet that embraces those attributes, because it's very difficult to put whole food combinations together on a regular basis that do all these things.
I'd like to actually do some studies where we can actually test some blood sugars of these people, like after before they do the shake, after they do the shake, and we can actually show that the blood sugars are remaining in a healthy range.
Well, one of the things that my colleague, Dr. Arciero, and I have done in a pilot study is to look at this in a very sort of primordial way, and that is just to expose people who were either, you know, pre-diabetic or frankly diabetic to regular doses of particular dairy proteins and see what happens, you know, at the level of both their, you know, whole body response and also at the more nuanced level of individual molecular and biochemical responses in the blood that can be measured. And we find that, you know, this effect, if you leverage, you know, the gut, brain, and enterohepatic circulation and its, you know, regulatory influences with polypeptides, you can change people's, you know, profiles metabolically from horrific to normal in a very short period of time. And you get
things
like very selective reductions in abdominal fat, which is a very significant finding. And that occurs with the simple, you know, institution of, you know, 60 grams of a protein source on a daily basis without changing anything else. These effects are very significant, and that's what really is underappreciated, that because of protein's preeminence in the diet, because it is the supply of amino acids, which, you know, really call the shots everywhere, the importance of trying to optimize this really can't be overemphasized. It's kind of a recurring theme of mine. The amino acids are the keystone of metabolic control. And it makes a difference, you know, what source of amino acids and what form they're presented in and the dynamic of your eating them and how they're processed after you eat them. That makes a big difference in the whole body response. So that's something we're going to be talking a lot about. And
I think this is certainly a topic of further discussion. But the bottom line is, to sum up what was going on and what we spoke about, to have tight control of blood sugar, you really have to, number one, look at the protein sources you're eating. Number two, look at the carbohydrate sources you're eating and look at the quantities of them that you're eating. And I think it's got to be the responsibility of the individual to get their blood work done and to make sure that they have this tight blood sugar control. And don't be surprised, as you said, if you're eating these high glycemic carbs on a regular basis and enormous amounts of them, that you're going to have complications that might result in a beta cell death or poor blood sugar control later in life. I mean, that would be a pretty accurate assumption.
Yeah, if you want to get more specific, you know, there's actually human data that has looked at this pretty succinctly. And the suggestion that I would make to people is that, you know, an ingestion of, you know, 40 grams of carbohydrate, of any carbohydrate at a maximum per, you know, meal, quote unquote, would be the upper limit. And recall that basically a critical component of this is not to eat pure carbohydrate meals. You should not, you know, exceed a carbohydrate to protein ratio of more than 1.5 to 1. And if you wanted to be, you know, more precise, 1 to 1 would be my suggestion. That would allow the average person to target, you know, a total carbohydrate intake per day of around 120 to 150 grams.
And obviously, I agree. Perfect.
The restriction would be to make sure as few of those carbohydrate grams as possible come from the monosaccharides.
Well, you know that you're my pick for Surgeon General. Whether it happens or not some days, it remains to be seen. But Scott, we will be back next week. Thanks once again for all the information. I'm Dave Palumbo with Scott Connolly for Muscle University.
This has been another episode of Physique Star Radio, exclusively on RxMuscle.com. Be sure to visit Myotropics.com for the most innovative physique nutrition supplements available today.